I'm Mike Mason with a check of the local news on KDLG. The man who oversees all of the rural campuses of the University of Alaska Fairbanks has been touring those campuses since being appointed to the job back in July. Yvonne Peter visited the Bristol Bay campus last week. He's the new vice chancellor for rural community and native education. As part of that job, Peter's in charge of the College of Rural and Community Development. That includes all of the UAF rural campuses. Peter says the campuses serve a vital role.
A lot of work happens in rural Alaska, and there's a lot of opportunities for us to train and educate our citizens, especially our young people, to be able to fulfill positions within all of those different industries, both in the private and the public sector that exist out here. And so just for that reason alone, they're critically important.
Yvonne Peter is himself a graduate of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He graduated with a bachelor's degree in Alaskan Native Studies in 1998.
I returned after finishing my bachelor's degree to run one of the rural campus centers for the university. And so my professional career began with the UAF. And after serving in that role for a couple of years, I moved home to Arctic Village and served as a chief for my tribe there and really started to learn what the challenges are that our people face in a small tribe in trying to generate economic development and to manage the current funding streams, to manage housing projects, to manage our airport, you know, to oversee, you name it, that's happening in a small community. And so that was really a important time for me to really gain a perspective on really what the challenges are that our really small communities face from a position of management.
As part of his new job, Peter is tasked with championing the importance of higher education for the rural residents of Alaska. He says one of the goals is to start that higher education process as early as possible.
One of the areas that are emerging right now, and that has already been for a while, is early college, is providing opportunities for our high school students to be able to take college courses, receive credit both at the university level, but then also at the high school level, because a lot of our students are ready for it. And it provides them that opportunity and a clear pathway for them as they finish high school to go on into post-secondary education. And with the way our economy is right now, not only within Alaska, but nationally and globally, we really are living in a time where it's important for our K through 12 students to really understand that their education doesn't end after high school. It's important for them to continue the pursuit of knowledge and skill sets so that, you know, they can provide for themselves, they can provide for their families, and they become another resource and asset within our communities.
The entire University of Alaska system has embraced the use of distance learning technologies, and nowhere is that more evident than at the rural campuses. Peter says it's critical for the university to use these new tools to reach students at or near where they actually live and work.
We have the early e-learning center at UAF that's really in the process of delivering a lot of course load. And it's the largest growth area, actually, of our student body and credit hour count within the university system is in e-learning. So people are tapping into the mechanisms of being able to use the internet, use audio conferencing, use different forms of technologies, video teleconferencing units, to be able to really offer educational opportunities at the community level. And so we have, you know, just here at Bristol Bay, I was doing the tour of the new, what soon to be LEED certified building, where they're going to be providing the training for RNs, for local nurses. There's already some local graduates from that program. They're going to be expanding that to accept more students in this next cohort that they're starting up. And a lot of that is technology-based education, so that they're linking in some instructors from Anchorage here out, you know, through the video teleconference to be able to provide that educational service.
UAF has been facing some budget cuts, and by all accounts, the entire university system is bracing for additional cuts. Peter says essentially UAF had a 5% across the board budget cut.
If we have to go through another set of budget cuts, though, in this next cycle, it will begin to impact our programs. There's no way around that, because we, in order for us to sustain the faculty, the staff support to help those programs going, as well as to cover the costs of all the materials and supplies for different courses and programs that we're offering, there will begin that process of likely having to start looking at which programs are the ones that are having the largest impact at the community level, and where we have a the largest demand from students.
Yvonne Peter has only been on the job as the new vice chancellor for rural, community, and Native education at UAF since late July, and last week's visit to the Bristol Bay campus in Dillingham was his first visit in his new position. In the coming months, he plans to visit all of the rural campuses and learning centers in the College of Rural and Community Development. Those in favor of passing Proposition 2 on the November ballot recently received a significant endorsement from an out-of-state source. KDLG's Thea Card has the details.
Ballot Measure 2 would make the use and purchase of marijuana legal for those 21 and older, create a marijuana control board, and tax pot at $50 per ounce wholesale. Although it's already legal for Alaskans to possess small amounts in their homes, Prop 2 would mean that Alaskans could buy pot from a store instead of resorting to illegal drug deals. Earlier this month, the New York Times released an editorial column that states those on the editorial board agree and support the pro-marijuana measures on the ballots in Alaska, Oregon, and Washington, D.C. The column says the measures would, quote, effectively disregard the misguided federal ban on drug that is far less dangerous than alcohol. Spokesperson for the Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol Vote Yes on 2 campaign in Anchorage, Taylor Bickford, says the endorsement from the New York Times is important because it's the country's newspaper of record.
Voters across the country and in Alaska are becoming increasingly aware of the failure of our current marijuana policies. And we've had a system in place for decades that has unnecessarily criminalized otherwise law-abiding Alaskans simply for using a substance that is far safer than alcohol, both to the individual and to society.
Bickford says the New York Times backing of legalizing marijuana reflects the growing attitude of residents in Alaska.
As time goes on, more and more Americans are going to come to this conclusion, and more Alaskans are going to come to this conclusion. And if you believe that arresting people in this state for marijuana is a waste of time and that it's unnecessary, then you have the chance to exercise your voice on November 4th by voting yes on ballot measure 2.
In Alaska, the Alaska State Troopers Bureau of Investigation Statewide Drug Enforcement Unit reports in 2013 there were over 650 marijuana-related charges and arrests. The column in the New York Times says after decades of arresting people for buying, selling, and using marijuana, society, and particularly minority communities, are hurt disproportionately by the harsh criminal penalties of prohibition. In Dillingham, I'm Thea Card.
As climate change brings new threats to subsistence communities across Alaska's coastlines, a conference held in Anchorage is advocating community-based solutions and not waiting any longer for government assistance. KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports.
The 7th Annual Northwest Tribal Water Rights Conference wrapped up on Friday in Anchorage. This year's focus was on how climate change is eating away at the shoreline across rural Alaska and how communities there are taking matters into their own hands. Hal Shepard directs the Center for Water Advocacy, which organized the two-day event held at the Pioneer Schoolhouse. He says the nonprofit organization is broadly focused on water issues, emphasizing specific concerns raised by tribal partners.
Probably the most pertinent issue right now in Alaska for Native village communities is coastal flooding and erosion. So that is causing some, some villages are considering moving the villages because it's a safety issue. They get these huge waves and inundation from the seas.
Presentations touched on the Norton Bay Climate Change Adaptation Plan, which Shepard says is the only comprehensive strategy he knows of for dealing with current environmental changes in coastal Alaska. The plan offers a dramatic shift in how communities deal with the interwoven hazards of erosion, worsening fall storms, and destructive flooding. In the last few years, communities like Shishmaref, Kivalina, and Newtok have had halting starts and stops, coordinating site relocations with the Army Corps of Engineers and other agencies. Now, Shepard and others are stressing, don't hold your breath.
We really try to emphasize, again, the tribal focus on managing their own resources and the ability, not only the expertise, but the legal authority that tribes, we believe, have to do that because they're the most impacted by climate change. It just makes sense that they're the ones that should take the lead in managing resources to protect their communities.
For examples of how that looks on the ground, Shepard and others point to the communities around Norton Bay in the southeastern pocket of the Seward Peninsula. Terry Johnson with the University of Alaska recounted Shaq Tulick's ongoing construction of a coastal berm to protect homes from storm surges and flooding. After years of paying outside consultants and waiting for agency plans to develop, residents there took it upon themselves to start filling mounds of driftwood with sand, gravel, and local grasses. It's hardly a silver bullet for climate change, but Shepard says those are the kinds of creative engineering solutions to hyperlocal problems emphasized in the Norton Bay Plan.
Everything from building, you know, encouraging beaver, who are some of the most expertise hydrologists we have, and building beaver dams and controlling flows, natural flows of water.
Rose Kalistuk works for the Orutsararmiut Native Council in Bethel and represents the more than 200 tribes in the EPA's Region 10 area covering Alaska. She says it's not just government agencies that are failing to help with mitigation efforts.
Especially when it comes to climate change and coastal erosion, the villages are losing their lands. The native corporations which own the lands have not done anything. They have not moved forward helping the villages.
Like the approach laid out in CWA's Norton Bay Plan, Kalistuk's advice for going forward is clear.
Do not sit and wait. Just do it on your own. Otherwise, you're going to lose everything you have.
Many of the presenters and visiting officials at last week's conference are preparing to rehash issues and solutions around climate change in February at the Alaska Forum on the Environment back in Anchorage. For KSKA, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Officials at Anchorage's International Airport confirmed that flights were briefly grounded Saturday after someone called in a threat. Airport General Manager John Parrott says someone called Anchorage police dispatchers shortly before 9 p.m. Saturday and said the next plane departing would explode. According to KTVA, someone was taken into custody in connection with the call. Parrott says that federal authorities grounded all flights at the airport for about 20 minutes. A new report out of Oregon suggests that Alaska's workers' compensation premium rate is dropping. KDLG's Thea Card has more.
The Oregon Workers' Compensation Premium Rate Ranking Summary is based on methods that put states' workers' compensation rates on a comparable basis. The study uses classification codes from the National Council on Compensation Insurance. The report shows Alaska was leading in the nation in workers' compensation premiums, but now the state's premium is getting better. Research analyst with the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services, Jay Dotter, says the report starts with a survey sent out to every state.
What we're trying to do is come up with a comparison of workers' comp cost between states. It's going to include what we call the loss cost, which are the part of the premium that goes for paying claims now and future. The other part is everything else that goes into it, the assessments, what the insurer needs to charge to make money on it. And we're trying to come up with this equivalent index rate that compares all the states together.
The report is conducted once every 2 years. However, the report is specifically designed to help Oregon compare itself to other states. There are some states like Alaska that lump all trucking together into one category, but there are several different kinds in Oregon. The analysts simply make basic categories that are similar among all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Dotter says the main reason he sees Alaska's premiums going down has to do with the lowering cost of medical care and less number of claims.
Make the workplace safer, and you have fewer claims, and that helps keep the cost down.
Alaska employers paid about $300,000 million in workers' compensation insurance premiums in 2013. Those lower premiums saved Alaska businesses about $6 million in 2014. Director of the Alaska Division of Workers' Compensation, Michael Monagle, says although it's definitely worth noting Alaska's new rating, it's not because of any policy change.
You know, we've had, again, over a four-year period, about a 4% decrease in overall costs. For us, for Alaska, those declines are primarily because of frequency. That is, the number of injuries that happen each year. If you look back, about 20 years ago, Alaska had over 30,000 reported injuries per year. This last year, for which we have data for calendar year 2013, that's dropped down to about 19,000 reported injuries.
Alaska ranks fifth behind California, Connecticut, New Jersey, and New York. Monagle says he noticed the other states that were in the top 10 with Alaska.
Of the top 10 states, five of them are located in the Northeast, where if you look at some of the data, the cost for medical treatment in the Northeast states is very high, like it is in Alaska.
In 2002, Alaska ranked 15th, but by 2006, Alaska was up to first in premiums. In Dillingham, I'm Thea Card.
Independent candidate for Governor Bill Walker received the endorsement of several law enforcement and public safety professionals in Anchorage last week. Representatives from groups including the Alaska State Troopers, Public Safety Employees Association, the Alaska Professional Firefighters Association, ANC, and the Anchorage Police Department employees all offered their endorsement to Walker. Walker says the Parnell administration is disconnected from real Alaskans and their day-to-day realities, including those faced by public safety personnel. He says he will meet with representatives on a regular basis to make sure his actions are having the appropriate effects. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has released its summary report for the 2014 commercial salmon fishing season in Cook Inlet. As KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, continued low king salmon numbers and new management tools were at the heart of this year's fishing effort.
The total number of sockeye salmon caught by Upper Cook Inlet commercial fishermen was down this year, some 20% less than the 10-year average. But at about $2.25 per pound, some $35 million worth of fish were still harvested. That dip in sheer numbers caught doesn't have anything to do with the run strength of sockeye, but rather the lack of run strength for king salmon.
The Chinook salmon, as everybody, or the king salmon, everybody knows, came back again 2014, pretty small runs.
That's Commercial Fisheries Manager Pat Shields. Under new rules approved by the Board of Fish for this year, restrictions put on in-river fishing for kings had to be reflected in similar restrictions for the commercial fleets.
So when the sport fishery went to a catch-and-release fishery, starting on July 1, the commercial set net fishery started the season with no regular periods and then a maximum number of hours of 36 that could be fished during the year. And the department attempted to use those hours to maximize sockeye harvest and to stay off of kings as much as possible.
That was the big point made during those winter meetings with the Board of Fish way back in February. Let's target the sockeye when they're on the beach and then back off. And while this move was somewhat satisfactory, or at least a step in the right direction for in-river users wanting more kings, the sockeye hunters were worried about over-escapement, letting too many fish back up the river. And those concerns weren't without merit. The Kisilof River saw record or near-record returns on several days throughout July, and widespread use of the Kisilof River Special Harvest Area, better known as the Terminal Fishery, continued this year.
It's an imperfect tool. You can use any analogy you want. You know, that we're taking a crescent wrench to rebuild a motor. But it's really the only tool we have to try to keep the sockeye escapement down in the Kisilof River, and then we use the drift fleet extensively to try to harvest as many sockeye as we can out in the middle of the inlet, and because they're a very minor harvester of king salmon.
The terminal fishery at the mouth of the Kisilof was actually designated for a totally different purpose. Originally, it was only supposed to be used when Kenai River sockeye numbers were down, the thought being that commercial fishers could hit the Kisilof until more reds came in further north. But now, and for the past few years actually, it's being used to let king salmon pass through, though new genetic testing tells us that a few Kenai kings get picked up there too.
You know, you put that all together in your basket of management options and you mix it all up, and it doesn't come out very pretty. But it's really what we have to deal with, this inequality that we have right now, poor king runs and good sockeye runs.
Shields says concerns about overescapement on the Kisilof weren't limited to arguments heard during the Board of Fish meetings. They came pretty much immediately after the season began.
In the Kisilof sockeye run this year, from day one, put us in a box between a rock and a hard place that we really didn't want to be. And what I mean by that is there was a large escapement early from the very beginning. They showed up strongly. So we figured out pretty early in the season that we likely were going to escape that system, not because we wanted to, but because of the large run that was coming back early and strong.
And in fact, both the Kenai and the Kisilov River saw sockeye runs exceed their hoped-for return numbers by more than 300,000 fish in the Kenai and about 100,000 in the Kisilov. The late-run Kenai Kings hit the lower end of their escapement goal with approximately 16,000 fish coming back. Just 5,300 made it back in the early run, and commercial fishermen also took in about 2,000 king salmon in 2014. The Board of Fish is scheduled to take up Cook Inlet issues again in 2017, but will be lobbied hard to move some of that work ahead this week. There are 9 out-of-cycle proposals for the board to hear about when it meets for a work session later this week in Juneau. Reporting in Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Many of the stories you hear during the KDLG local news can be found online at kdlg.org. You can also find contact information on that website if you would like to provide a comment, a correction, or a news tip. That's a check of the local news on listener-supported public radio KDLG. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason, reporting.